you've made it this far into our three-part literary extravaganza, congratulations! You may just be nearly as crazy as the participants! This particular segment of our highly detailed conversation with Eric Kraft shifted our conversational location to a bar, and this environment may likewise explain some of the strange and odd tangents that arose in the talking process. Now listen quite carefully, you may just learn a bit of pivotal information about the relationship between writers and socks.
The question I wanted to ask was right after that, and that is the notion of what you wrote in 2003 article of the St. Petersburg Times. You pointed out that it was more helpful for you to write about a location when you weren't actually in that particular location. And I'm curious as to why that is. And likewise, as the Leroy books have gone along, we've seen more of this peripatetic impulse of wandering around. Why does this go back to the question of verisimilitude that we were talking about before, or what?
More to the limiting effect that the facts have. Maddie and I, every once in a while, are tempted to go back to Babylon, Long Island, where we both met and where we were high school students and so on. You don't have much desire to go back, I think. But I have sometimes wanted to go back in order to look at the scenery, to absorb some details that might be useful to me for Babington and Peter Leroy's past. And I curbed the impulse because I realized that this would be limiting, that I would begin trying to faithfully record what I saw there, perhaps trying to make his memories closer to my own, and that would be a terrible mistake at this point. I'm not writing my memoirs. I'm having Peter Leroy write his memoirs. And so in that sense, I think it's important to be distanced from the facts, from the place. The effective place can be so strong, so powerful. I think American literature has always had a very strong attachment to place. I think the country has been such a startling background for the adventures, whether it's Huck Finn or almost any American author, starting with the New England. I don't want that limitation. I want the freedom of not being so tightly tied to the place as it is, but rather tied to a place as I imagine it. Oh, I missed you, Sarah.
No problem. Well, there's also this issue of whether one can have too many facts at one's disposal. This is kind of related to my earlier question about taking a structure and being too attached to that particular structure. Would you say that this is the same thing to real facts with the Leroy books, that having too much topographical detail that you are dealing with on a quotidian basis is in fact going to harm the inventive process of the Peter Leroy narrative?
I think so. I think you lose the elasticity that you want in the imaginative reconstruction of events. You begin to be more locked into the precise recollection of events and that's not what I'm after.
I wanted to ask about the muses in Peter's life. We touched upon it briefly, of course, Albertine, who we were talking about, but also Miss Rheingold as well, who is the first person who Peter confesses to loving in a complex manner. You have, of course, the dark-haired girl in Flying Home, which itself may be the same mysterious girl that is in the final pages of At Home with the Glynns. Mm-hmm. The Aerocycle itself is arguably a muse. Yes. Why does Peter need a muse almost at every instant, it seems? It's almost as if when he strays further away from the present details concerning Albertine, because a lot of these muses tend to pop up later in the books as well. So what of this?
Every storyteller needs an audience. That's the first most obvious thing. But very early on, I think Peter discovers that a willing audience is perhaps a potential conquest. He sees it. He recognizes that if he has any power over people, but let's say over the women who attract him particularly, it's the power of his storytelling. It seems to be the one thing that he can really do that can win over a woman or a girl that he's attracted to. And once he discovers that, he develops it, develops the skill for that purpose. So these women and girls become both muses and audience and objects of lust as well as affection. Yeah.
Is this why, for example, we have the gradual augmentation of swagger as we go further along in the Peter LeRoy book, that there needs to be some, I suppose, he has to seduce as well the male audience, too.
Yeah. He is learning. You know, I hadn't thought of this. He looks so enviously at those flying EMTs and the way that they swagger, and he can see immediately that they have reason to swagger to a degree. They do something daring, they do something valuable, and they're in danger part of the time. And he envies them that, having that allows them to swagger, and that perhaps gives them whatever it is it takes to swagger. He has begun to have something that allows him to swagger, and is his ability to tell this story and to use it. Yeah.
It's interesting that you use the word swagger in flying, because it's very similar to digress as well.
Yes, in fact, close to stagger.
Yes, there is that. In fact, we haven't even talked about the notion of misheard literalisms that is throughout all of the Peter LeRoy books, and we should probably talk about. It perhaps is most notable in the flying trilogy with the 1,000 Happy Dinners, as opposed to 1,000 Happy Diners, in which it takes on an entirely different and rather funny meaning from its original intention. And then, of course, the pragmatic Matthew comes along and starts to quibble over whether Emil has feelings and the like.
Yes.
And this likewise takes us quite naturally into the talking spirit of the Aerocycle, who does in fact exhibit many emotions and is in many ways one of the most compelling characters in the book. Mm-hmm. So I have to ask about this creation process and how do misheard literalisms along these lines really allow you to find that particular direction, the spontaneity that we were talking about earlier? This is really the way to go for you? Or?
They do at times. You know, many of the things that I wind up writing about turn out to be as much about the telling of them in words as they are about the events themselves. In fact, very quickly, if Peter starts to tell a story, a certain portion of the telling takes on a life of its own, and he becomes as interested in the expression of an event or the expression of a reaction to an event as he is in the event itself. And words are so important to him that when they're misused or when they are misapprehended, which is what is happening to him all the time, he mishears something and so on, that he latches on to that literalism. Well, the way any of us who care about words, who have the soul of the poet, are as intrigued by the ways in which they're mangled, and either in the hearing or the speaking, as in their strong, accurate use.
There is one question I have in relation to Reservations Recommended that I have to ask, and that is in relation to B.W. Beef, which I believe could be, because the prose style is really, really similar, based on the pseudonymous Boston Phoenix restaurant critic Robert Nadeau. Nadeau. And it's interesting because I noticed that he blurbed the book.
Right.
I also know that his real name, Mark Zanger, well, Zang in German, of course, is actually forceps or a barber's instrument. Really crafty of you there, Kraft. What happened here? I have to ask if he was one of the galvanizing forces that led you to Reservations Recommended. And I also have to ask, because I know in an interview that you did with the Washington Post shortly before, while you were writing Reservations Recommended, you pointed out that, oh, well, everyone is calling my work warm and cuddly and endearing, and I'm sick of that. Is this why this book, which I really like, by the way, just so tough and nasty? And also the Nadeau connection, you have to go ahead and clarify this for the record. I'm sorry.
Well, let's start with Nadeau and then remind me that we want to come back to why the tough, nasty book. I used to write for the Phoenix.
Yes.
I did rock criticism for them, starting when they were Boston After Dark, before they became the Phoenix. I didn't know him then, and I'm not sure that our tenure there even overlapped. But we were in Boston, so I did read him. For a while, I wrote some restaurant reviews for New England Monthly, so I had a persona of my own that I was able to draw on for that. And
did you have a specific pseudonym? Or?
No, I think we were allowed only initials, and I think I did use my own initials, but the articles were not otherwise signed, or the reviews were not otherwise signed, and the editor specifically wanted people to go edgy, turn a little nasty whenever possible, on the theory that this was what people wanted to read. And I quit soon after that because it wasn't really in me. It did turn out to be in B.W. Beef, but not in me. Shortly after Nadeau reviewed the book, we met him at a wedding where he was a guest as we were. And both laughed about the way many people thought that perhaps he was the original of B.W. Beef. I pointed out that he really wasn't. And he he liked some of the characterization anyway, whether it was based on him or not. But the nastiness was in part a reaction. I knew where the angry characters were in the work. I knew where the nasty characters were in the work, and nobody seemed to be noticing them. And I was tired of having people characterize the book as warm and nostalgic and even as escapist, which I certainly never considered it. And so there was a certain element of, oh yeah, escapist? Ha, take that.
Yeah.
To doing Reservations Recommended. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm also curious, though, if this is also one of the reasons why the books became more increasingly licentious as they went along, too, and more warped in this. I mean, well, warped is a word that I would use in, I don't know, a judgmental sense. So perverse, shall we say. I don't want to be judgmental because you do have, starting with Reservations Recommended, kinkier impulses that begin to creep into the telling of the tale. And so sure. Was this as much of a reaction as the warm and endearing, ha, he's a humorous kind of label?
I think in part it's two life journeys. First of all, the young Peter moving out of the innocence of childhood into all of the desires of adolescence and young manhood, which is about as far as he's gotten. And secondly, it's Peter the writer moving from late youth, from his 20s, say, when he begins to conceive this project, on through middle age, and middle age is really the time when we meet Matthew Barber becoming B.W. Beef. So I think it's those two things. And so at the time of Reservations Recommended, you have a conjunction of two really key points of the lusty adolescent, young Peter, and the middle age crisis, older Peter. And that's where that perfect storm comes of all of these seething emotions and lusts.
What is the source of the odd smell in Matthew's apartment? I always wanted to know that. was this a personal experience?
We had a wonderful apartment in Boston. It had a largely glass ceiling in the living room and expanses of glass that looked out over all of the South End. And it leaked. And the source of this leak could not be discovered. People were up on the roof. They were tearing the walls apart trying to find it. And they would think that they had it solved. They would button everything back up. And soon I would come out into the living room in the early morning and I'd feel water under my feet. It would get onto the concrete slab. It would creep under the carpeting and it was like a swamp. Wow. So that's the source of the smell.
I wanted to also ask about this. Well, you had mentioned the story about how you and Madeline met. And the skeptical part of me says, yeah, 800 perfect SATs. Yeah, right. But my skeptical part also comes about because I learned in my research that you claim that when you were a boy, you sent off a letter to Gene Shepard. Mm-hmm. Which makes, and this makes complete sense now in terms of the tone of your narratives. And Shepard not only read the letter, but he based an entire show around your letter. The letter, interestingly enough, involved how to subvert the world of Dick and Jane. And I'm like, okay, I can kind of believe this. And then when you confess, as a boy, mind you, this also involved substituting martini onions for marbles. I don't know about that. How much of this particular story is true? How much of this is just smoke up the posterior?
All of that's actually true.
Is it?
That's
really?
All actually true.
As a kid, yeah. How did you get up on the martini onions as a kid?
Just elaborating the, from watching adults drink martinis or Gibson's in this case with the onions. That was something a kid had many opportunities to observe in the milieu in which I lived. Shepard, I listened to him as a boy, and we listened right on into our early 30s. I guess he was still, not quite, but almost. And the night that he read that letter, I was screaming for my parents to come up and listen to this show. They were probably in bed, but I would listen late at night, and he did exactly that. He built a show around it. He kept saying, this kid's only 12 or whatever I was.
So Gene Shepard is essentially Baldy's nightcap? Or?
There's a lot of that in there. Yeah.
Except he's a little bit rougher Baldy as well.
Yeah.
I also wanted to ask you about a month-long automobile trip that you and Madeline did to promote Herb and Lorna. This is interesting because you and Madeline stopped in town names that you liked. Loving New Mexico,
yes,
Opportunity, Washington, Paradise, Montana. Now we read the Flying Trilogy, and lo and behold, Peter and Albertine are also making an automobile trip, except an electro flyer. However, they have names that they like, Seaview, Cornfields, and Happy Valley. So now it seems to me that in dwelling on the present, you're increasingly dwelling upon the recent present as well with these things.
The trip that Madeline and I made was after the publication of Herb and Lorna.
Yeah.
And we quite deliberately went to towns that Herb and Lorna had visited when they made their American trailer tour after Herb retired from Babington Studebaker. He converted an Avanti to tow a trailer and they took off. And they visited all of those towns loving. Each of the towns that they visited had some reference to something that had happened in their lives. So we visited several of the same towns, the ones that it was fairly convenient for us to visit. Here in the trip that Peter and Albertine, of course, they're reconstructing the trip that Peter made on the Aerocycle, heading from Babington out to Carrasco, New Mexico. I, in the summer following my junior year of high school, spent a summer in Socorro, New Mexico, at an institute sponsored by the National Science Foundation for promising high school students who might help the United States beat the Soviet Union in the arms race, space race, or any other sort of race they might want to challenge us in. And we studied mathematics, physics, not weaponry, though, geology. Why geology? I don't know. I guess they felt that this was a dangerous area of competition with the Soviets at the time.
I have to ask if your grandparents actually essentially took a length on a map and decided to go to Babylon.
No.
No?
That was just geometry thrown into the story. It just sounded to me like a wonderful way to decide for Herb and Lorna to decide.
I could buy that, actually. I could buy a random choice like that.
Yeah, and it was also Lorna's affection for mathematics problems. So here was a little geometry problem for her to work with.
I also know that your childhood pal, Ed Zeron, is Rascal.
No.
Now.
Oh, no. That's what Ed thought. No.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is that why you made him a composite character in the later books to kind of clarify that particular detail?
I may have been influenced by that feeling. There was a night when Ed came to visit us in East Hampton many years after the particular story that I'll tell you. Appeared in one of the novellas of Little Follies. And we had lots of drinks and got to reminiscing and so on. And he said, one of the things I'll never forget is that that trip we made up the river in Babylon, is it Carl's River? Carl's River, I guess, to the source. And I looked at him and said, Ed, we never did that. I said, that's a story. It's a story I wrote. And he said, yeah, but it was a great story anyway.
So in this case, Pete LaRoy had a great sort of influence on your friend's memory.
Absolutely. I mean, wow. It shows that there are quantum effects that occur on the macro level. You can actually change the past.
Are you sure you weren't a propaganda writer in the past?
No, that was so he isn't Rascal, but there was a time when he was sure he was.
When you received the advance from Warner Brothers for the first four volumes of LaRoy, was that for the first four novellas or was that for the first four books? I was curious.
Actually, Warner Brothers was reprinting at that
point. Oh, I
see. Yeah,
I see. So
they had already been published by Applewood Books.
Yeah.
And so, yeah,
it
was the first four novellas.
Well, the thing that was interesting is that Warner editor-in-chief Bernard Shear Cliffe boldly announced, I want to make him a famous writer.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to get us back into a question that you didn't
answer. Why hasn't that happened?
Yeah. Well, we'll make you famous as much as we can. We'll make you famous. Going back to the question before we were kicked out of the last place, I was asking you about how Random House's purchase of Crown in 1988 had an effect on your books. You were talking a little bit about getting the rights back so they would have a complete set of this, but in light of, you know, Shear Cliffe made a bold claim, Crown was behind you, then they get absorbed by Random House. So,
right.
So how have you kept up the jumping up through hoops or making uphill battles, uphill values, as you said?
Right. Yeah. You know that the changes that have occurred along the way in the publishing industry have just seemed always to have been working to the detriment of making this work all available. The most wonderful thing that did happen was that when St. Martin's Press launched the Picador USA imprint, it was my great good fortune that there were three advocates for my work at that time, George Whitty, Cal Morgan, and Peter Ganay, who said they wanted to produce exactly what I wanted, which was uniform editions in paperback of the books that had been published so far, which they immediately did as part of the first list for Picador USA. And that was such a wonderful time. That was the time when, for the first time, everything clearly looked to be of a piece and was all available at the same time. Since that time, of course, you know, things have shifted a little and some of the books have fallen out of print, but otherwise the unity was there.
Yeah. Well, this is, again, the mid-lister's dilemma, particularly when you have a situation here in which you have this all-expansive work in many volumes. I mean, have you essentially stopped caring about sales? Do you not care about sales? Do you care about attention? Or, I mean, you know, in my case, I only found out about you because your books happened to be at City Lights, and it's like, what the hell is this?
What a wonderful way to find them, by the way.
Exactly.
That is that pleases me very much. There's a line in, I think it's in Woman of the Year, when Spencer Tracy it looks at Katharine Hepburn. And he says, well, there ain't much there, but what's there is churse. And that's what Madeline says about my readership. I don't have a lot of readers, but they certainly are choice. The letters I get from people are so penetrating. The people who do read it and who go on reading it are people who really get it. And that's a great pleasure. I wish they were a legion, but they don't happen to be.
But has it ever occurred to you to try to make a big score in terms of like writing a completely commercial book in an effort to kind of get people attached into the Pete LaRoy universe? Or is such a thing absolutely impossible? Or did you in fact try to do this and it turned out to be so quirky and eccentric that I'm just curious?
Yeah. Where is it? It's not. I've forgotten what book it is. Where there is there, Well, we there's won't
the,
even try.
Yeah, one there, of the books, there's the publishing there. Meeting. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
I think it's the first
it's
in Manhattan.
Peter's,
yeah.
It's in Leaving Small Hotel, right. Where Peter's publishers want him to add more blood and yeah. gore to the Larry Peter yeah. series, and he can't do it. It doesn't work out that way. It keeps turning into quirky Larry Peter stories. And I'm much the same way. I don't think I could possibly do it. I haven't bothered wasting my time trying to do it. And the other way I've managed to shoot myself in the foot so very well is in the matter of film sales. When Herb and Lorna was released and was reviewed on the front page of the New York Times, I got a call almost the next day from Amblin, Steven Spielberg's company. And I spoke with people there, and we had a number of interesting conversations. And I think perhaps in the second or third phone call, I said, of course, the one thing that's of great concern to me is that because I have plans for all of these characters, there are many, many other things I want to do with them, I would have to retain control of the characters. There was a silence, and essentially after that, a click.
Oh my God.
It wasn't quite like that, but it was almost like that, that the matter was at an end.
Wow.
And there have been other little explorations from Hollywood and so on, and I've basically said the same thing. However, now that I've brought the characters along as far as I have, I'm ready. So,
yeah. Well, this makes me curious about a parallel universe in which you would open up a Happy Meal and get a piece of erotic jewelry. I think
yes,
that would be very good for America,
yeah.
I think
that the marketing rights are something that we really have to...
Yeah, but simultaneously...
And Leroy Lager, I think, could be launched
yeah.
as well.
Mm-hmm. But simultaneously...
A poem on the back of each bottle.
Simultaneously, you did write a screenplay for Inflating a Dog. So you were actually trying to do a big score here, or at least some sort of film out of the deal.
Actually, that was a time when there was no work for us in educational publishing. I couldn't find any work at all, and I had a lot of time on my hands. And I was thinking, what could I do that might bring in some cash? So there were two things that seemed to me like brilliant ideas. Write a screenplay based on Inflating a Dog and approach Eli Zabar about turning the shopping experience at the Vinegar Factory into something like a treasure hunt, where I would write descriptions of the foods that would lead people from one thing to another, which gave me an astonishing day with Eli Zabar whizzing around town from one shop to another. But
wow.
He almost liked the idea.
I have a very, very important question that relates to your 2001 Washington Post review of Donald M. Murray's My Twice-Lived Life. You open this piece with this very pithy observation. You observe that aged male writers are much inclined to self-congratulation and repetition, haunted by people they have loved and lost, deeply disturbed by socks, and constitutionally unable to prevent themselves from cobbling together yet another book. Now... this makes a good deal of sense to me, the issue of socks and how this relates to your own output. The sense I get here, however, is that irrespective of what is there in the Bailey book, and he does have a very strange relationship with socks.
And so did Murray. Both of them, they seem to be terrified by socks. It was, yeah.
Yeah, but this leads me to ask you whether you have a relationship with socks that is of great concern to you and that is in relation to your artistic output. I must divine from your wisdom that as I grow older, if I attempt to write books, that socks, the fear of socks, will in fact become major issue.
Leitmotif.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have a really strong attitude toward socks myself.
Yeah.
I have a lot of socks. And there are some that I'm especially
fond of. Some that are mismatched,
yeah.
A mismatched sock in the house? I've got plenty.
Madeline won't allow that.
Oh.
No, can't be done. Yeah, they have to go out in pairs.
It's,
But
right. To compare socks...
It's like the wife throwing herself on the funeral pyre. You know, the sock that doesn't have a hole has to just give itself up and go out with the one that does, right?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if socks can be put on the same level as self-congratulation and repetition. Because I mean, there are three definite values in this opening sentence.
For the two people I was reviewing, yeah, they seemed to occupy as important a spot in the personal view as self.
Yeah. Do you write in your socks? In nothing but your socks?
No.
No? You have to have shoes on when you write?
No, no, we're only into technique now.
Yeah, we are. I need to know exactly what you wear because, you know, this is an issue that People Magazine likewise needs to know.
Oh, sure.
We're trying to make you famous, right?
Yeah.
So what do you wear
when
you're
writing? That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. I don't know the brand names of any of these things
the
designer labels.
For you. Yeah.
Because I get up early, I put my gym wear on. So I'm usually wearing shorts with an elastic waistband, you know, ready, looking forward to the gym, a t-shirt, a sweatshirt if it's cold, and those funny little socks that you wear in your running shoes that don't come up very high. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. In a 1997 Newsday article, you pointed out that you were identified as a Long Islander, even though you left Long Island at the age of 16,
right,
and you had spent the next 26 years living in New England.
Yes.
What specifically do you think gave you away? You didn't really elaborate that on the piece, but I think that since 1997, you have had 12 years to think about this, and I'm in the business right now of quoting to you articles that you wrote in 1997.
Yes,
so
yes.
I'm just trying to tie this all in together.
So you mean what gave me away as a
Long
Islander?
I want you to answer for every article you wrote in 1997. This is the second one we'll lay down on the table.
Right. Well, I think because Peter has barely left Long Island. I'm talking about the younger Peter now, the Peter remembered by the older Peter. So there's a Long Island focus to all of his reminiscences. It's still there. He's a Long Island boy. The Peter writing the memoirs is not. He's a man of, he says at one point, a man of Manhattan, and even to a certain degree, a man of the world, because he does go to some conferences of memoirists and so on in Europe and even at one point, I think, in Australia. So he's spread his wings a little bit, but still the focus of his memoirs at this point is Long Island exclusively and almost exclusively Babington.
Gotcha. Yeah. Now here is another very important question. You and Madeline were identified as experienced tequila drinkers in a 1996 Smart Money article. You identified Hornitos as warm, soft, and friendly. You suggested that Herradura should be used for medicinal purposes only, and Madeline called it harsh. Of Patron, you called it a boring friend. Madeline said that it had no aftertaste. And of Sauza Tres Generaciones, you noted it gives you a big taste as soon as you put it in your mouth, then it fades. Madeline said that it was watered down. Now, I'm exceptionally curious about this. How does one become, as
a tequila
designated, an experienced tequila drinker?
There's exactly.
Is it the variety of a tequila?
There's a standard application process, and there's a screening, a set of interviews that you have to go through as you kind of make your way up the ladder. You begin as a neophyte tequila taster,
okay. And
then you advance into the higher echelon. This came about because living on the East End, you know, it's a nest of vipers out there writing for here, there, and everywhere. So a friend got a gig writing tasting reviews for, was it Men's Health? Where did
it was
that
Smart
appear?
Money.
Oh, Smart Money.
Smart Money.
Okay.
There's no space between smart and money, by the way.
Oh, okay. Smart Money. Smart Money. Yeah. As opposed to Men's Health.
Yeah.
Which could
sort of like the smartphone, you know.
That could be Men's Shelf, yeah. So they wouldn't really want to do that. But he gathered his friends, a number of his friends, together. Among them, Harry Hurt, who just finished his gig doing executive pursuits for the business. Yes, I think he just wrote his last piece. I think it was announced as his last piece. So we all got together, sitting around a table, and did a blind tasting of tequilas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we had established earlier that martinis are, in fact, the real part of Eric and Madeline, and they have crossed over into Peter and Albertine.
Yes.
Now,
and tequila. Luis Buñuel
and
his wife ended every day. Actually, I think the day tended to end around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, but with martinis as well.
Got it.
Yeah.
But, if you are both experienced tequila drinkers, why is there no tequila in the Pilar
experienced. Our tequila experience really spanned only that one afternoon. We began as neophytes. And a few hours later, we were experienced tequila drinkers.
And yet you were
widely
quoted.
The smart
you were
money was.
Than, yeah. Wow. I wanted to also ask you about your insistence that you don't have a cult audience. You insist that your work has an enthusiastic following of people who are very interesting characters. Now, this is very lawyerly of you. I'm curious right. about...
Cult audience.
Should you even be concerned about audience? I mean, you have a small but dedicated readership.
Yeah, right. So I'm concerned about the quality of the audience.
Yeah.
And if I have a small audience willing to send me bags of cash, that's perfectly fine.
Do you get bags of cash in the mail?
No. It's my small audience doesn't seem to have access to bags of cash.
But I mean, this notion of do you even care about an audience at this point, or do you just keep on writing?
Oh, I do. I write to be read. I actually, the first thing I write is to be listened to, because I read everything to Madeline.
Yeah.
And so shouldn't I be content if she responds just as I would want to have her respond? Of course I should. But I ain't. Yeah. You know, it's... I would like to have a larger audience. Now I'm asking myself why I care.
Why do you care?
Well, I know why I used to care. And maybe the reason I care still is just a remnant of why I used to care. When I was always working to make a living at something that I didn't particularly want to do, which was writing these textbooks, something that I'd just fallen into, but it wound up being what I did, and so why take the risk of doing something else so long as I was making some money? But I always wanted to get away from it. I wanted to stop doing what I was told to do and be able to do what I thought I was meant to do. I wished that I had an audience large enough to sustain that without my having to support it.
Yeah.
But
you knew, though, with the newsletter that you initially set out to various people, 250 friends and
right.
250 friends of friends,
right.
That, well, there are people who read you, who really dig you, but it still remains a small subset.
Right.
So therefore, you have known all along, and this makes me kind of suspicious about caring about an audience. Is it more about money, or is it about the audience?
Well, you're making me ask myself, because it really was about money. A certain level of money, something that would sustain us, in the life to which we'd grown accustomed, which wasn't a particularly elaborate life, just a life that would give comfort to write and so on. Now, I hardly need them. Yeah, hell with them.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like telling a story at a party. You hope that, you know, six people gather around you and not just that one guy who keeps looking at his watch.
This leads me to also ask, because one of our roundtable participants, Brian Slattery, made this very interesting observation of your work, that, Kraft's work is funny, the jokes are funny, because they're the kind of jokes you hear around bars. And I'm wondering how many of these stories and these jokes are recycled from bars. I should put that...
No, they are what I wish I heard in bars. For a long time, Madeline and I thought that we would meet interesting conversationalists in bars, that we would have interesting conversations, that we would meet interesting people, and we never have until today. It's really the first experience.
That's good.
These are really more the stories I wish we'd heard in bars.
Yeah. So where does this dialogue come from? Just
from me.
Voices.
I mean, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, one little word phrase at a time. It does accumulate that way. This is all painfully pulled out of.
I'm wondering if there are scraps of dialogue ideas or scraps of jokes that you have in a drawer that you're waiting, like, oh, I could put this in this Peter LeRoy book or something like that? Or is
not
it just
anymore. There really were. I mean, I did start with that. I wrote exactly that sort of thing, scraps of dialogue, little exchanges between Peter and Albertine, exchanges between other people in Babington and that sort of thing, a conversation with Peter and his grandmother, say, or something like that, and never saw how they were going to fit together until I put them all away and began to turn to them as memories rather than as things that I would turn to and look and say, oh, gosh, I really want to fit this in. Instead, wait for them to come drifting back as memories. In essence, and I really have to be careful when I speak about a memory of Peter's coming back to him that he's going to write about, because there is that element of it that there. When I sit down and I'm writing as Peter, I enter the character of Peter. I write as Peter. I think as Peter, but always with a shell of Eric above it. I don't want to sound nuts about this. I am in control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You had a very crazy expression when you said that. I scared me. But actually, this notion of control is interesting because I know you got a late start on these particular stories, and I'm wondering if one of the hurdles for you starting into this was this notion of holding on to scraps, holding on to ideas,
it was
planning everything around, and that you had to essentially, that almost the Peter LeRoy books helped train you to just basically go ahead and trust your gut, and trust your instinct here.
Yes, this is it was that point at which typically in a novel about a novelist, he burns his juvenilia, you know, and turns to something else. I didn't burn it. I put it in cartons, taped them up, and said, okay, that's over there. If I feel I need to go back and look at that, it's still there. That's comforting. That's a good thought. But now it's set aside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a past life. Or perhaps a life to be resuscitated in a future Peter LeRoy
and
book.
And to be recalled. To be
used
that
way. Aspiring Boston writer, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, that'll happen.
Eric, we have talked one hell of a long time, but I want to thank you very much for taking the time out of your schedule. I hope we have created one of the more definitive interviews of your...
I think so.
touching many points, but thanks very much for your time.
Don't you have anything from my... I think I gave a pretty interesting address at the close of the sixth grade where... I guess you don't have that.
No, was that? I don't. It's not on Lexus Academic University, I'm sure.
Damn.
I'll be sure. But it will be.
Well, thank you.
But thanks very much.
All right. It's been a treat.